Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. In this episode of Regenerative Mindset, I catch up with the incredible multi-hyphenate Victoria Riskin, an accomplished writer, producer, psychologist, and now publisher. She has been a lifelong passionate advocate for human rights and sustainability. Vicky enjoyed a long career in psychology before transitioning to television, where she became an award-winning writer and producer, earning accolades such as the Producers Guild of America's Television Producer of the Year. She also served as president of the Writers Guild of America West, championing the rights of thousands of screenwriters. Vicky has dedicated her life to advocacy, using storytelling as a catalyst for change, co-founding Human Rights Watch councils in both Los Angeles and Santa Barbara, as well as the Global Council. After losing her home in the aftermath of the Thomas Fire, she founded the award-winning media platform Blue Dot Living, empowering communities to embrace sustainable lifestyle choices and take meaningful action to reverse climate change. In our conversation, Vicky shares her journey from growing up as the daughter of Hollywood royal couple Fay Wray and Robert Riskin to building a movement that connects people through media, fosters community-driven solutions, and inspires the next generation of climate leaders. Join me for this discussion with a remarkable changemaker whose work continues to shape the cultural and environmental landscape. Hello, Vicky. It's so good to see you. I'm so happy you're here.
Any time with you is joy time.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Well, I have had you in my sights for a long time. We're friends. We met many moons ago around a Human Rights Watch organization event or program, which you inspired me to get deeply involved with. But since then, you have inspired me on many things. And so I am just excited to really share you with the audience. What I want to do is start with, if you would, it's not a small task, but I really love asking the question about your path to where you are now. You're many things, but currently one of your main things is the creator and editor of Blue Dot Media. And so that's one of your passions right now. And I also feel it's an accumulation or a product of so, so many things. So could you give us a little hint at where you're from?
Well, first of all, I think I should just lie down on the couch because I always feel like I can just talk to you so openly. Well, Blue Dot came out of just a moment in my life where I realized that the most important thing we all could be talking about and thinking about is climate change. Now, that is a big word, and we use it a lot. We banter that word around. Some people don't like it. But what it really means is that the planet is warming, and there's so many consequences that are coming out of that. And there's so much that we can all do together. That's very much the spirit of everything I've done in my life. It's galvanizing people around something important and in a positive way. And so the idea of Blue Dot was a media company that would have different tools to influence the zeitgeist in the country so that people would begin to see in little bits and pieces in different ways they can be part of the solution, and it can be joyful and it can be positive and constructive, including around food, which I know is something that you care a lot about, and how we grow food, how we get rid of food, and the methane gas that comes out of food. So anyway, it started with a magazine, and it now is nationwide, a series of communication tools, let's say, including magazines and a whole system of newsletters that are local and national.
Yes. And I really want you to get more deeply into some of those programs, because you go several very good directions. And I think the future for Blue Dot is very powerful, and I'm on board with it. But I'm also intrigued with, you were born of two Hollywood famous parents who were part of the golden era, you might call it, that also went through challenges. Both of your parents had their own unique sets of challenges, but gifts as well. And how was that? Because you've written a beautiful book that describes the lives of your parents.
Well, that was an amazing experience to dive into their lives. You know, you were born to people and you just want to make sure the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in your lunchbox at the right time. And then you open up the box of who they really are. And for me, it was an amazing, challenging, interesting, fascinating journey to find not only them, but to go back in time to Hollywood in the days of silent movies and into talkies. And what role did they play and why did they come to Hollywood? So my mother, most people know of as the star of King Kong, Fay Wray. So that was a film. She made over 100 films, but that's the signature film that everyone remembers. And I have to tell you a little embarrassingly that very often a young man, an older man will say to me, I first saw your mother in King Kong and I fell in love with her. Because there was something about that character that was a combination of a little bit sexy, but a little bit innocent. And including Peter Jackson, who is the famous director who made a sequel of King Kong. What was amazing to me was to go down that same road of what was it like to build an entire entertainment industry in Los Angeles in the 1930s and 40s. All the challenges, you know, labor challenges, technological challenges, creative challenges, social divide, and so on, and then see how they fit. My dad wrote probably, you know, a handful of the most celebrated films of the 1930s. So that would include It Happened One Night, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Lost Horizon, You Can't Take It With You, Lady for a Day, Meet John Doe. These were very much known as the kind of populist, in a good sense of the word populist. They were films about people kind of, in a way, struggling through the Depression, but they were romantic. They call them romantic comedies, rom-coms. He kind of invented, or at least fine-tuned, that genre. It says a lot about him, the themes that he chose, and I think I've been influenced a lot by him. And those themes were how to bring important stories to the public about injustice, about struggle, about unfairness, about whatever, because in the 1930s, it was the Depression, but do it in a way that people loved the story and loved the people. So it was always charming, funny. He had a wonderful sense of wit. So they sort of held the test of time because they were really quite remarkable.
Well, again, his name was Robert Riskin, and it's called Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir, and they were truly in love. You found letters between them, and She sounds to have had, I mean, besides whatever persona she had on film or her most famous film, she had a really plucky pioneer spirit is what comes through, I feel. And she lived a very long life, whereas your father had a really strong, deeply grounded, warm energy, came from immigrants, but his life was foreshortened. But yet you actually embody the two of them. In many ways, I would say.
Yeah, that was a challenge. It took me a while. I did a whole manuscript that I then put on the shelf and started over again because I knew I had to weave them together, but in a way where they had their own separate identities for much of the story, but keep the reader interested in getting them together.
Great job.
Thank you.
I think it's really an enjoyable book. Yeah. And anybody that loves Hollywood history or just history in general, honestly.
Yeah, it does touch on a lot of American history, the war and so on, the Depression. I will just say, because we're friends, that it was nominated as Best Biography by the LA Times Book Festival. And all the reviews were terrific. So that's the thing, you just, you know. Whew.
You never know. But you know, Vicky, I've never known you to go at anything half-assed. Excellence is in your DNA, I think.
Well, thank you. I'm a little bit like a dog with a bone. That's how I think of myself. I just don't want to give up till it's right. And it was a struggle, you know, to write, you know, make sure I was using the right words. I had an editor who, if she's watching this, she'll understand. She was very tough, not very directive, and not all that helpful, except she once said to me, "Why do you use so many adverbs?" And I thought, yeah, I better take those adverbs out.
Isn't that funny? I'm going to tell you, there's probably an English teacher that said you need more to make for good creative writing. You're going to need more.
She was right. I mean, you know, I was slightly over-describing things, but it meant a lot of research and digging into, as you mentioned, their love letters. That comes later in the book. But what were the movies they were making and who were the people they were working with? And how did my dad get to Hollywood and what had happened before? And my mother, as you said, had a pioneer spirit. She was 14 years old, Stacy, when her mother, who didn't quite have enough money to feed the kids and no husband, she had six children, put my mother on a train to Hollywood with a young man who was in his 20s who said, "I can get Faye in the movies, maybe."
What could go wrong? That sounds insane. But it went well, didn't it?
And she was thrilled. She was thrilled to get away from her overbearing mother. She was thrilled to have an adventure. I think he was a little odd, you know, taking a young girl to Hollywood. But she navigated all of that. And then when her mother finally thought maybe something untoward is going on, I don't think it was in the modern sense. You know, he had a crush on her, I'm sure. Her mother got on the train and came and yanked her away from the grasp of this guy. But still, she found her way into the movie business. And by the time she was 16, she was supporting her whole family, all six kids, and her mother. And by the time she was 19, she was married and she was a superstar. You know, that can be really kind of, well, first of all, it was kind of a funky town in those days, not like today. No paparazzi and the brush of newspaper men following you everywhere. But she navigated all of that, and she navigated a very difficult marriage with an extremely talented and good-looking young man that she first married. She navigated my sister, her first child, being kidnapped by that first husband. She navigated so many things. And so I went back and read all the newspaper clippings and her notes, and I dove into that. But my real motivation, because I knew my mother, she lived till she was 97. It was my dad I was looking for, because I had lost him when he died when I was 10. He got sick when I was 5. And I just missed him so horribly. I mean, it's just the grief of the ages, it felt like. And then finally, something in me said, well, who was he really? I mean, I had a kind of idealized view of him, and yet so much grief around him, losing him, that the book was a journey to discover the person, the real person, who I ended up loving even more, but in a more realistic way, who was this guy. And funny, when I was little, I used to look up at him. He seemed kind of like a giant, but he was only a little bit taller than me. He was like 5'7". He was short for a man. And so when I finished the book, he was the right size physically, you know, in my mind.
Oh, that's so interesting. That is, I mean, let's mention you are a psychologist. That was one of your first careers, is psychologist. But I think that's fascinating. And I'd say that is the work of a lifetime for all of us, is to start with our family of origin and wherever those wounds are, and show me the person that doesn't have any. But I also was so interested that he was making films during World War II that were informational for sort of the spirit of the war, the effort, helping to bridge the American people. I'm not sure how to explain it, but I was really interested, having just done a deep dive on Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt's time frame, which, you know, that was his time frame.
So I'm going to recommend something to you that would be a little icing on the cake on this part of the story. It's a documentary called Projections of America. I think it's on Amazon Prime. And it was the springboard for my book, in a way, because I had a call from a German documentary filmmaker, and she said, I want to do a movie, a documentary about your father and World War II and what he did. And I said, well, that's very nice, you know, thinking nobody ever has any money for documentaries. And I said, but why? And she said, because your father made these films that told the story of what America was really like in kind of a positive twist. And they were films, maybe 15, 20 minute films, little documentaries. And they were shown overseas as the Army of Liberation went from North Africa up through Italy into France and then finally into Germany. My dad's task was to make the films, get people to make the films, and then literally truck them behind the army and open up theaters. His view was, if the people who had lived under fascism really understood America, instead of all the terrible propaganda, like how many gangsters there are everywhere, if they could really understand America, they would like us. So this was just a very simple idea. How can we use film to help particularly Germans appreciate and like us? And she said, this documentary filmmaker, that her grandparents talked about seeing those films and falling in love with America. So I said, well, when you have the money, you know, let me know and I'm happy to help. She said, oh, we're all funded. I just want to have you meet the director. He's a great guy who had worked with Ken Burns. And we'd like to make the film and have your cooperation. And I said, you have 100% of my cooperation. So you can see that film and see what he did. Now, I'm just going to add a little coda to this story, Stacy, because how do you tell the story of America? If I said to you, what stories would you tell? He told the story of the guy who washes the windows on the Empire State Building. And it's a sort of a Buster Keaton kind of character, and he climbs out the window and he goes up and down the Empire State Building. But the point in the background, you see the amazing skyline of New York, the big buildings, the shiny buildings. That's America. Then he did another one about a cowboy in the West, and another one with Ingrid Bergman about the immigrants who came to Minnesota and started farms. And then he did another one about an immigrant, they don't say Jewish, but a Jewish family who escapes and comes to a small town in New England, and how people are suspicious of this newcomer who doesn't speak English. But little by little, the town learns that this is an interesting person, and he plays the violin and he's a cultured man, you know, and so on. Learning how to adjust to foreigners. Each of the little films had a purpose and they were loved. And I think he was personally responsible, and his team, for opening in Italy alone, like 3,000 little theaters, reopening the theaters, bringing electricity back. So it was an invasion of ideas.
I love that phrase, invasion of ideas. And what storytelling as the oil that might grease the wheel of connection between humans, between people. And guess who that reminds me of? You. And I think, you know, you're a storyteller. And what I want to say before we go another minute is, I mean, because there's so many ways I see this theme in your life, but one of the funnest ones is the way you run a dinner party table. And what is it you call yourself again?
A dinner party dictator.
That's right. And you can be my dictator because you have a knack for taking a diverse and large, I've been at large tables with you where I feel like I had the most intimate connection with a large group of the most interesting people. You bring out the best, you bring out what would make other people open up to them. And you have that through and through. I mean, I love that, the storytelling. And I sense that Blue Dot has that woven in throughout because we do need to unify and recognize each other in these stories of regeneration, resilience.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think people always long for connection. It's not new to this generation, but we are more fragmented, it feels, than ever. People don't even sit at dinner tables in their families anymore. We recently did in Blue Dot a story about a dining table and where it came from and, you know, the importance of sitting around a dinner table. But I think that's what people long for and why they're so restless and unhappy, because there isn't that sense of being seen and heard and appreciated, regardless of your worldview. You can have an unusual worldview, and being able to bounce off of that in a respectful way. I have one friend who said to me, are we going to do the single conversation at dinner? And I said, yes, and you're going to participate.
Share or die, as our friend Nancy used to say. That's right. But it works out. Like, I might feel pressured. And then at the end, how do I feel? And that's the thing, is how I feel leaving one of your gatherings or one of my own, because I totally have cheated off of your rigor. It lends a feeling, and that's what we remember, is how we feel and the connections.
You don't remember all the conversation or the stories. You remember how you feel. But it's a little bit like being a conductor, because if somebody goes on too long, what do? That's where the dictator comes in. And I'll say, you know, that is so interesting. I wonder what Stacy thinks about that.
I think there's someone on the other end of the table that may want to comment. Right. Well, it all works out. But I guess I just want to comment on the influence of your folks. And even if your father, you know, died too early for you, he made a huge impact on you. And you have adopted many of his qualities, that warmth and that love and that humor and all of that. I mean, there's so much in reading about him that I see in you. In your youth, you grew up in LA, right? And starting in Bel Air, which was where those who were, let's say, successful in LA at the time lived. And then there was a move after he died. Your mom had to support the family. And there was a move a little bit further west into Brentwood. I just have to say, as we're recording this, there are fires burning in LA in the neighborhood that you grew up in.
Yeah. It was a big loss to move from Bel Air to Brentwood, because that was like very, you know, kind of middle class, and we were kind of more Hollywood royalty. Of course, I look back on that, Stacy, and I think, oh, my mother did what she needed to do to take care of us. She just did it, you know. I don't know how she felt. Maybe it was hard for her, but that was Brentwood and then Palisades. And it was a continuum. So I grew up in Brentwood, but I went to school at the Pacific Palisades High School. And I was in the first graduating class. And we were so proud of that beautiful new school. And most people who know the Pacific Palisades live in LA. It's like a small town. People feel very connected to that place, like I feel where I live now on Martha's Vineyard, where you have a sense of responsibility and caring and pride in your community. And for whatever reason, the Palisades had been able to hold that spirit all these years. Now to see it just completely wiped out and so many of our friends without homes anymore and trying to figure out what to do. And mostly, as you know, I try to look at the opportunities and what we can do around climate change and these unusual weather events. But this just knocked me off my feet. I just said, I have to have a moment of teariness. I have to have a little cry here over this because it's so big and so profound and it's not over. As you and I are talking right now, we're still waiting to hear what the next winds might do. And you know me, I'm always looking for the little silver lining. I sent a note to all of the publications we do that are digital with a little note from me about that town and what's happened to our friends and to our city and what's happening to our planet. And so many people responded to that. And I've seen this when it happened in Santa Barbara with the fires and the floods. The goodness of people comes out too, a lot more than in our ordinary kind of mundane life. And it reminded me of 9/11. I don't know if you remember how you felt that morning. I went to the supermarket and I was going up and down the aisle looking at the shoppers thinking, so happy you're here. I hope you're okay. You know, it's in my mind. I wasn't saying this, but this amount of, it was like a surge of compassion.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to just mention as well right here is as much as you are currently feeling that village that you grew up in that had its own center, its own heart and soul, some of us that don't know that area, let's say if somebody doesn't know it, I happen to know it, but it sounds like, oh, celebrity central or whatnot. But no, it actually does have that quality that you mentioned. It developed that quality that you mentioned, and that's unique. And what I want to say is you also lost your home in the early 2018 mudslides. That's worth mentioning here because you have personally been affected by a climate disaster related event. And also the Bucket Brigade and everything that came out of that, all the people that pulled together. I mean, your home was so special. It really was special. And the memories, you know, everything had meaning is what it felt like being in your home. That feeling that we all felt in the community of Montecito, which is more of a village. It has been more of a village. It has that heart and soul and that center to it. But feeling that, oh, I hope this feeling doesn't go away. And of course it did. And there's people that have moved in, the vacant lots that were created, new people build, and new people that don't have the history, don't know what happened here. And we kind of forget, not that anything bad happens, but that extra special love for each other, compassion. What do you need? How are you? I get chills just saying that, just of what it was like going to the market and seeing people.
For sure. I mean, it was both devastating and comforting. And I'm sorry for the new people who come in because they don't have that bonding, you know. And one of my favorite restaurants was Via Vai up in the Upper Village. You know, I know it's not there anymore. I'm so sad about that. See, that also bothers me. But when we came back for the first time after the complete devastation and loss of our house, there were a bunch of bottles of wine that we dug out of the mud. And we didn't know if it was, you know, cheap wine or if it was
good stuff.
Good stuff. Because there were no labels. So we took all those bottles to Via Vai. We invited like 50 people to come and have dinner. We would treat everybody to dinner. And, you know, it was a way of also helping a restaurant that was suffering because it was not so much business at that time. We opened the bottles and then at the end, we ran in and got a big pot and we had everybody put 20 or 30 or 40 bucks into the pot and gave it to the waiters. That's community and caring.
It just feels good. And there's something to me about your metaphor of the wine without labels. And there's something about when we're all stripped of our labels through some kind of a catastrophe, it's just the essence of who we are. at base, we are able to love each other. We are able to feel empathy if we can know each other as essential human beings. And so that's something that I feel you understand. And you understand it at the most simple level, but in many, many cases, you have taken it to a large canvas, like expanding Human Rights Watch. I don't know if it was anywhere besides New York at the time that you got involved in Human Rights Watch, let's just say.
Well, it was basically a New York organization. And they came to Hollywood thinking that's where all the money is, and they wanted to fundraise. And I said, sure, but you need to create community here so that people really care, not just so that, you know, they get their name on the roster of an annual report. So there were three of us kicked it off, and then we just kept adding and adding and created a whole support group, maybe 50, 60 people. And then we replicated that in Santa Barbara when I moved to Santa Barbara and met you. And then we replicated that. And I think there were ultimately about 20 cities around the world. This idea of this circle of people. And it's hard going because if you don't have the right leadership, and this is another topic that I care a lot about, if you don't have the right leadership, the right spirit, the right ethos, it won't work. You know, and people, we bring them into these circles, and you hope they will ultimately contribute, you need to make sure they also feel included and that it isn't just write a check and go away. And so we did that, and we ended up creating something called the International Council for Human Rights, and the folks would get together once a year in some city around the world. And the next one is in Toronto. And COVID sort of put a damper on us all getting together, but we'll do it again, you know.
That event, I would say the Human Rights Watch event, was one of the highest grossing fundraisers that I participated in. And it was the most enjoyable event I went to all year. I looked forward to it and blocked out time for it. It's like when you're there, everywhere the eye lands, it's like all the best-hearted people were there. It's a funny thing because philanthropy is a subject here. That's the gross national product of Santa Barbara, I believe, is philanthropy. And which, God bless, you know, it's a high median income here. Makes sense. But I think that event, you want to give. It's like energy, love, compassion, important information and sharing, and therefore also money flowed, you know, like it made you reach a little deeper. And you always brought interesting human lives there to tell their story. So you would share that.
Yeah. So sometimes we would bring somebody from Africa or someone who had been in prison somewhere, and they would tell their story, or somebody from the former Yugoslavia who had been caught up in the war. And our staff as well are pretty courageous, and they tell their story, but they're always kind of also focusing on the people that are in those countries that they're working to protect and, you know, give human rights protections. I think that's what touches people. It used to be, Stacey, we always had in LA a movie star. And I remember, you know, at some point I said, forget the movie stars. Forget the movie stars.
Yeah, I miss the movie star phase. That's funny.
Isn't that funny? Because it's not what made people want to be there. You know, they wanted to be there to see the real people. The one movie star, I cannot tell you all the funny stories about working with movie stars because that's not fair. But the one that was amazing was Helen Mirren. And our friend, you probably know Annie Bardak of Santa Barbara. I said, do you know Helen Mirren? Of course I do. So she picks up the phone and calls her on her private cell phone and says, Vicki would like you to come and be the MC for this big dinner in Los Angeles. So we chatted and I said, could I write your remarks? You know, I'm happy to do that. And so she said, no, I'll write my remarks. And she sent them and I was in tears the minute I read them. She had been to Darfur. She knew what was going on. Many of the other famous celebrities that we had had not had those experiences to be able to talk in that kind of real way, the way Helen, of course, she's a remarkable person anyway. So just to underscore your point is what people come to the dinner for is to hear the stories of those real people, our researchers who were in the field, who were taking the testimony of people in very serious circumstances and fighting very hard to protect them. It is much more difficult today, Stacey, than it has ever been, because the respect for human rights was always part of the fabric of American values. Even if we argued about international treaties and should we sign them or not, I mean, there was a basic concept that America represented democracy and human rights. And there's no one now about to be new government who has any clue about that. Even consideration that possibly this new government will unsign the Geneva Conventions, which is unthinkable. You know, it's almost unthinkable. So these are, I don't mean to be a Pollyanna about everything. This is going to be a very tough period of time in terms of lots of things, human rights, climate change. We have work to do.
Of course, you're right there, because we have to all have an understanding that human rights and dignity and respect for the earth, for human beings, no matter what, those are the bases. And if we can't agree on that, then it makes the task harder. But I think about the time that your folks lived through with blacklisting in Hollywood and what was going on before and during World War II and that whole era and the huge crash in 1929, there was a lot of things going on at that era too. And new things, new organizations, new programs, new inspiration came out of those times. And you know about this. I mean, you come from this. These are your people.
Well, the whole labor movement starting in the 20s, but really in the 30s and FDR and his government.
Eleanor. I'm going to put a plug for Eleanor.
Yes, and the International Declaration of Human Rights was the thing she was most proud of. But the labor movement in the 30s, but all even before World War II, there was a real divide in the country. Those who thought that the solution to terrible famine and unemployment was something more like communism, where everybody had a guaranteed meal and housing and work. And that was very threatening to many people. And so there was a support for Nazism. Huge movement in this country to support Hitler.
So I didn't really realize that until I started digging into that history.
Yeah, it's an amazing history. And Rachel Maddow does an amazing job of a podcast where she goes back and unearths some of the important stories of that time. And Lindbergh, who was so famous as a pilot, was very pro-German, even had a secret German family, I think. But just to say that there was this divide, and before the war, there was beginning of the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, and they came to Hollywood and they began to call people into the, you know, hotel rooms and interrogate them. That kind of was on hold for much of the war, but it never really went away. And as soon as the war was over, then you had the serious hearings and the Hollywood 10, who were mostly writers, one director, who refused to name names. And some may have been communists, some may not have been, but I think they were all kind of had at some time been members of the party. They were, you know, sent to prison for contempt of Congress. Ultimately, that escalated to a point where Joe McCarthy and actually a young senator named Robert F. Kennedy was on that committee. He later expressed his chagrin that he'd been involved, but they began to pull people before, and finally it was stopped. It's hard to imagine because you have a PhD, you've been through school. What if, you know, half of your professors are fired because they're members of the, or even thought to be members of the Communist Party.
Or whatever the latest and greatest threat is, somebody decides that it is a threat. Yeah, that's right. And so those are fears that a lot of people remember. So the question is, you know, identifying, connecting around our commonalities, our shared humanity. For me, that is what I feel that Blue Dot is seeking to achieve. And I have to say, and I know I've said this before, that you're answering one of my prayers, because I got into really learning about climate change and speaking about gathering groups around emotional and psychological barriers to engaging with climate change as a psychologist. But it was amazing how many people didn't want to talk about it. But now the science and the experience is becoming undeniable. How do we go from fear or believing an all or nothing solution and start to, I think about the motivation that FDR was able to motivate in people around. We need to pull together on something that affects us all.
Well, you know, I think different parts to that, Stacey. I mean, I'm with you. People, if they're too frightened, they're paralyzed, they're immobilized. So they have to see the possibilities and the hope. Now, since I've been doing Blue Dot, I see it everywhere. You know, it's a little like whatever you do in life, you suddenly see hope and possibilities and success everywhere. But it sometimes comes with challenges. And I'll give you an example. There were a group of people on Martha's Vineyard who worked for 10 years to bring a wind farm to the East Coast, to the Cape Cod area, big wind farm. That meant working with the state government and finding a company and encouraging them to apply. Anyway, that big wind farm now has the potential of providing energy for almost all of Massachusetts, 60, 70%. Renewable energy, and maybe even beyond. But how do the fishermen feel? You know, and they don't like the look of it. And it's disturbing nature. And some of the wealthy people who have nice views on Martha's Vineyard suddenly see, even though it's several miles out, a big wind farm. So even where you have success, there are tension points as we get used to this change. And I think, how do we bring people together so that we don't demonize the other or the project, hear each other? And that's the challenge. That's what I'm hoping to be able to do, whether it's on Martha's Vineyard or in Santa Barbara with the Sable oil problem. As you know, I'm very concerned about that.
And you're the one that brought Sable Pipeline to my attention, and now I'm deeply engaged.
I was stunned when a friend of mine sent me, he has a newsletter that goes to the financial markets, and he sent me a story about Sable Offshore Oil saying that they were going to restart oil drilling in Santa Barbara Channel as of last October was the date that they had initially announced. And I said to him, this is crazy. This will never happen. People in Santa Barbara would never let this happen. And then I sat down with Linda Kropp, who I've introduced you to from the Environmental Defense Center, and she said, oh, yes, and this is moving very swiftly. And it even moved through the Planning Commission recently, and now the Board of Supervisors will have to take a vote on transferring the lease from Exxon, who've held these assets, and they're giving them to a very new underfunded company and loaning them $750 million to restart this oil coming out of the ocean into this pipeline that is old and rusted. And the environmental impact report that the county did itself, although it's not released it, says it's likely to cause an oil spill of the same magnitude of the 2015 oil spill every year.
Every year.
Every year.
450,000, no, was it 145,000 gallons of crude oil, 150 miles down coast.
And something even more catastrophic, likely every 4 years. So much less all the carbon that's going to be emitted from churning all this stuff up into an air that's saturated already with particles from fire. it's a disaster on all fronts. So now I'm diving in.
Well, the thing is that when I had a gathering of many different aspects of the local government, private, public, university, county, all the different people, philanthropists, and we identified the three main barriers to actually having resilient planning and reversing climate change in Santa Barbara County. And one was silos. People are in silos doing what they do and not aware of what anyone else is doing. The other is communication. There's not good around the, 360 communication and public support, which without it, these local governments can't sometimes push something through if they don't feel they have the will of the people. But the thing is the people don't know. It's hard for the people to show up. And that is what I believe Blue Dot is here to help solve. You reach me through email. Like, it's a digital magazine for my area specific, just to be clear, is there's a Blue Dot for my area. And so you bring me information and news and opportunities and recipes and products and all kinds of things specific to where I live. You allow us to communicate and it can help engage public support. And I kept feeling like there's a marketing job that we need here in Santa Barbara, something, we need something. And you have come along and that's what I am so excited and hopeful about with Blue Dot.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that is my dream. And at the same time, we need community and people coming together, Blue Dot Plus, it has to be Blue Dot Plus. Having our Jeffersonian dinner and people talking about this and engaging them, when I'm out there, I hope we can do that because I'm way back east now, but I've opened up a bunch of doors through Linda Kropp, who does the Environmental Defense Center, and then bringing other people to the table. And you came to the table and you said, wait, now that I know this is happening, so we could do this. We can do this. And next week's Independent is probably going to have her on the cover. And I wrote the story.
Meaning Linda Kropp?
Yeah, because she understands what government agencies are involved, what the legal issues are. She's extremely talented and great to work with. I feel if you see someone with talent like that, you get behind them and you help them with whatever they need.
Exactly. But you have the power through media, through storytelling. That's the thing. And that's you continuing your family lineage is how it feels to me.
I think it is. I think my dad comes through in a way because his view was the world could be a better place. And that if we all understood and we don't have to hit people over the head and scare them, we can charm them.
Well, and educate and inform, and when there is a human interest story, it's interesting. It's almost like the science of nature is how I might even describe what I've developed an interest in. I've always loved being in nature. It offers us something always, but learning about how, let's say, regenerative agriculture and the methods for that has given me a peek into the science of how nature actually works.
And it's mind-boggling, right?
It is.
I don't talk to the trees. I let the trees talk to me because that's where the wisdom is. It's in the trees. I know that sounds a little crazy, but I think we've cemented over nature so much, and failed to care for what's around us. And underneath those trees is this whole world of connectivity and the mother tree who takes care of the other trees. And you've gone deeply down that path. And that's so exciting. And so, as you know, one of the things I do as part of my Blue Dot universe is take kids into the mix because they're the ones inheriting this world. And so this March, I'm taking 20 kids to Santa Cruz Island. And they will be in nature and we'll teach them climate leadership in a very experiential way. They're going to learn about leadership and they won't have cell phones.
That's huge.
Isn't that huge? I'm so excited.
It actually is. Yeah. Good luck to you because the people I know that have led retreats for young people with digital cleanse, It's hard. It's hard.
It'd be hard for me.
I know. And yet it's rewarding. Well, it's funny, the tie-in with the Santa Cruz Island. It's off the coast of Santa Barbara, which is where I am and where you do a lot of your work. But FDR coined the term the Galapagos of the Northern Hemisphere because of the incredible diversity right in this section. I mean, and it's true. It's unique. You know, that's why it's even more imperative that this area really protect and be aware of what's going on. But I love that you're bringing the youth. You've been really building an institute for youth learning. You've got young people making films and writing pieces. Tell us a little bit about that.
I knew when I launched this whole idea of Blue Dot World, I had to have young people involved. And I felt high school, I want to start with high school, at least 16 to 18 year olds. And I felt if they learned something about what does it mean to be a leader, and they think deeply about it when they go through our little program, we put them through a lot of experiential stuff, improvisation kind of things to manifest themselves. And then pick a topic and talk to others about it and create circle, just exactly what we've been talking about. Teach the kids how to listen and be in a circle. And what happens for me, Stacy, is being around the kids totally invigorates me because they're so open and excited and they're doing writing. We have a separate website for them. And then they're writing. If it's really good, then goes on the national platforms or in the magazines. So it's like a little train, you know, of experience. And we have a couple of editors who work directly with the kids, and they have a very professional experience that way of what's it like to tell a story. And then the editor says, I think this sentence, you know, maybe belongs here. And what do you think? Can you talk more about that? And it's one-on-one mentorship. The kids last summer, we took to the MIT Media Lab in Boston for a week, and they are still friends. And that's the most gratifying thing, that they're still in touch.
Well, that is what I've noticed, is that everything you do at the highest possible level. And I know that your Martha's Vineyard magazine that was coming out, who you have on your team is like the New York Times editor. And I mean, you've won prizes, award winners. Those listening, if you have not yet checked out Blue Dot, please subscribe. I really recommend it. You also have a marketplace that advises on products that are earth friendly. Is there anything I'm missing here with Blue Dot?
No, I think if people want to sign up, it's free. So just sign up. We didn't want to have a paywall. And you can sign up for the national. It's called bluedotliving.com, and we call it the hub. And that comes out every other week. And then you could sign up for Blue Dot Living Santa Barbara. And that covers Santa Barbara and other, you know, Southern California stories we bring in. And then we have something called the Daily Dot. And it's just a little short piece to wake you up. And it could be a quote, or it could be a whole little mini essay or a tip. But it's like a friendly way to wake up and shift how you feel. Just a short little, it's like a hors d'oeuvre. And then the marketplace, we have a couple of hundred companies that we've looked at top to bottom that we think are pretty good doing the right thing. Because I think the consumer is incredibly powerful. So if you need a new pair of shoes, you could go here or you could go here. And there's a choice that could be better for the planet.
Right. And if that's your preference, we can trust that you've done the homework, which is really a service.
We're not perfect, but I think we're 90% perfect.
Well, so what cities are you representing now? Where is Blue Dot right now?
So San Diego, Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Boston, Brooklyn, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and Toronto. They're the cities, and we're kind of holding steady there because we want to not only grow our audience, but have a quality audience. In other words, you can have, you know, people sign up. Well, if they don't come back for 6 months, want to say thank you so much and make room for other people. But we hope to do other things like have some travel and membership program where you become a member and you get a little gift box and opportunities to make these connections.
Well, you know, you have something which some other periodicals have, and I like to participate in, which is there's an opportunity to make a payment. You know, like I make a donation to Truth Out. You know, I make a donation, I believe, monthly to Blue Dot.
You do. I'm very grateful.
Right. And so that's just a way to support. You know, I love to say, I think it's important what you're doing, and I want you to do more. So I just want to name that.
It's hugely important for us. And it's not a huge amount of money. It's, let's say, $50, $100 a year. But you can pay monthly. I think you can pay 25 a month or 10 a month, whatever. And, you know, as we're building a critical mass, that's what supports us. But it also means that the people who are in that membership program and support us are part of the Blue Dot universe. It's nice that we have the money. We need that money to, you know, grow. But also to build an ecosystem is sort of the way I think about it. Together, you're part of making this happen.
Well, to me, it's a form of democracy. It's like when I believe I want more of something, you know, I can vote with my pocketbook. And that's what I'm trying to do here, is really say, I need more of this. And the more we can connect and identify ourselves as people who do love the environment, who do care, that do believe we need to tend to the environment if we're going to survive, that's one way of doing it. And I'm so grateful for your leadership in that. That's one more thing I just want to circle, because I feel like you might have language around how do you understand leadership, because you have been a leader in different ways throughout your lifetime. And I'm just curious to know how you would speak of it.
Well, I think a good leader is someone who creates an atmosphere where somebody else or others want to do something and feel that it's their idea or comes through their own agency or their own wish. And a good leader sees the gifts that different people have and appreciates those gifts and doesn't try to change them so they have other gifts. And setting a good example, but you never get people to go where you want them to go if you dictate. I mean, I guess some dictators are very successful, but it's more out of fear, and those are negative impulses.
So allowing people to combine their own experience and orientation with, let's say, a task at hand, that if you can merge those two, each of us has a uniqueness, but then if there's a shared idea, a good leader is able to help people link up their own intentions with this shared goal, you might say.
And given who they are and their talent, are they shy? Are they outgoing? Are they wonky? Are they bringing their gifts to the table? And then I think I found myself feeling very lucky to have attracted just really wonderful people, people who I like.
They're not just talented, they're also really good folks.
Yeah, not perfect. Neither am I. I'm not perfect. None of us is perfect. And I guess that means being a little bit tolerant, trying to be tolerant. It's hard to be tolerant when you're on a mission. You know, you want things done.
But you know, you, I know, are informed by Buddhist philosophy. That's a whole other aspect of who you are. And does that factor into what we're speaking of?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I think that the gift of Buddhism or Buddhist philosophy is seeing that everything is invented. The thoughts that go through our head aren't real. And yet it's all the fabric of how human nature works. But seeing it with a little bit of air around it, you can see yourself a little bit more clearly. You know, if you get very upset about something, then you can sort of recognize that it's a story. So I think there's that kind of understanding in Buddhism that if you hold on too tightly to your story or your sense of who you are, you will suffer. I do thank the new president for being the poster child for human suffering. I mean, I don't thank him really, you know, I don't think he's going to help the country.
Well, that is sort of a tradition of, you know, those that are most challenging are teachers in Buddhism, I would say. Yeah. So you're saying that's an example we all get to see and reflect upon and decide how we want to do it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think you see, you know, like in Tibetan Buddhism, there are different sort of realms of suffering. And one of them, for example, is somebody with a very narrow gullet and a giant stomach. And what that's saying is that that person will never be satisfied, never fill up. And then there's the realm of the gods, the people with all the money and the suffering that comes with that, because you're always afraid of losing it, or there's never enough. So I think what I was drawn to in Buddhism was the psychology of it, you know, kind of the wisdom of it that way, but also the ability to see that I'm suffering emotionally because my pride is hurt, or what the cause of that suffering is. And then in Buddhist philosophy, the story is that there is a cause of suffering and there is a way out. There is a path to freedom. And so it's not about believing in an external God, but it's sort of cleansing yourself. That being said, Buddhism has been appropriated all over the world for people's own personal ambitions. So it's not a perfect religious tradition, but you peel away some of the layers and you see the extraordinary insights and the practices that help you see that.
Well, I see you to be a delicious blend of wisdom and maturity, as well as a perennial spring chicken. And as we've spoken of, you just stay in the game. And why would you ever not? Because keeping it going, keeping engaging, the interest with the young people and doing something. It's like regenerative mindset. The title of this podcast is all about how can I make things better every day that I'm here? Every day I'm on this planet. Why not?
And I think that's what we can do if we're lucky as human beings, you and me and others that we know, where you reinvent yourself and you suddenly are going down some delicious new roads, like you planted some new wonderful thing in your garden and it springs up and it's more beautiful than you could have imagined because you've allowed that regeneration to happen in your environment. And you're like a living example of that.
I want you to just, if there's a couple things, like is there something in particular you'd really love listeners to take with them? And you can take your time, you can take a moment, but is there anything in particular you'd love us to take away?
Well, I guess not to make soap operas in your life. Do something simple and kind to somebody else when that could mean looking them in the eye and saying hello, you know, connect. Keep it simple. Maybe forgive someone that you, forget that.
No, I was wowing because that is huge. Keep that on your list.
So I was thinking about that and I thought, there's one person I don't think I'm ready to forgive, but maybe I can. Maybe I can.
Well, I know. I'm going to guess who that is, but I'm going to say keeping it alive and continuing to hope and work toward that, I think is worthwhile. There was someone in my life, it took me a decade or two, but I got there. We got there. So stay with it. Yes.
All right. That's a tall order. But I do think there's a benefit because even the slightest energy around a resentment is painful.
Whatever we host in ourselves is what we bring into every moment. That's what I believe is that. And that's what I heard, believe it or not, I heard climate change is an inside job. So it's what we cultivate inside that I think that we bring, that energetic vibration that we bring to every moment influences others. And so if energy is contagious, how do you want to infect people today?
Yeah, that's a great line. How do you want to infect people today? It might be the lady at the checkout counter at the supermarket. After my mother passed away, people at the checkout counters sometimes, you know, recognize that we were related. they talked about how she made personal contact just as she was leaving the market with looking them in the eye. I mean, she made people feel really good about themselves. Sometimes it was because she was famous, so they loved that. But sometimes they didn't know who she was. You know, it was just that ability that she had to hook into somebody to say, I'm going to make you feel better about yourself.
That's a great tip. Well, thank you again so much for being with us. We could keep going, and maybe we'll just have to have you back because you're so interesting and wise and you share so beautifully. So thanks again for being here.
Anytime, Stacy. I just love being with you.
Me too. Okay. Take care. Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.